Guten Morgen.
Morning, everybody.
This is January 5th, 2021. Epiphany, right? Isn't it Epiphany today?
I think tomorrow.
Is it tomorrow?
No.
Oh, I made an Epiphany post on Facebook today, so I'm a day off. Can't expect much from someone with an evangelical background. That I even know right. That Epiphany at all is winning.
That's right. Exactly.
Hashtag winning.
Christian calendar? What's that?
Why do you need a calendar to be Christian? I'm a Christian 24/7.
You just need Jesus on your side.
No creed but Jesus. This is episode 148, White Cataclysm. Yes. And I'm Mark Van Stuyck. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. Mark is siding with me, saying Epiphany is always January 6th. So good morning to Mark and Kathleen and Susan. And so this is part of coup week, leading up to the coup. Today's the election in Georgia. Tomorrow is when Mike Pence gets beheaded in the public square for certifying Joe Biden winning the election. And so today's title comes from this book that I'm reading. I realize I left it downstairs, so I can't show you, but I have a picture of it, so I'm going to try to do this.
Wow, this is digital within digital within
digital. Digital within digital. That's a horrible image.
The Dawning of the Apocalypse.
Yes, The Dawning of the Apocalypse by Gerald Horn. He's a history professor at the University of Houston, I believe. And it's really an incredible book, unbelievably well researched. There are 75 pages of footnotes in this book, which I think I don't think I've ever seen that many. I certainly haven't seen more.
Oofta, as we would say, and in other parts.
And so basically what he is looking at is he's weaving together these themes of colonialism, capitalism, the rise of white supremacy, slavery in the 16th century. And he calls it the long 16th century because he's looking at 1492 to 1608.
What's 1608? Is that when Virginia colony?
No, Plymouth.
Plymouth. Okay.
Yeah. And so what's amazing about this book to me is what a great job he does showing how what has developed in Western Europe is basically this sort of voracious demon of conquest and cataclysm. And that the interplay between Spain and Portugal and England, France, some of the other more minor, the Dutch, Venice, what that does is it creates this foment of sort of endless drive for conquest, gold, people. One of the interesting things that happens early in the 16th century is that the Ottoman Empire in the East cuts off the slave trade from Eastern Europe. Like, I was not aware of, before there was this slave trade in Africa, there was this massive slave trade to Western Europe from Eastern Europe. And there were something like 1.5 million Poles, Bulgarians, various folks like that who were enslaved in Western Europe, to just do all this free labor. And so when that gets cut off, now they're like, well, we got to find slaves somewhere else. right? And so now we head to Africa. You know, of course, eventually we head to the Western Hemisphere. But what's interesting about that is what he describes is that, you know, because the folks in the Western Hemisphere were indigenous there and kind of had their own society and world and, you know, could run off into the jungle or revolt, you know, they weren't good slaves because they weren't subservient enough.
They have to be uprooted to be effective.
Yeah. And so basically it was just like, fine, let's just kill them all. And again, the depopulation of these areas is staggering, right? This one area that he talks about, you know, throughout the Caribbean went from a population of 1.5 million to a population of 15,000 within 2 decades. You know, now you think that's a lot of people you got to kill. Somebody could do the calculation of like how many people a day you would have to kill to get rid of 1.5 million people in a couple of decades. But it's, you know, it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And this is just all about taking over and making money. Mm-hmm. The better and better that Western Europe gets at that. And what was interesting is that that was aided by the Reformation. Aided by the Reformation, because now you had this development of what he calls pan-Europeanism, where instead of the situation with Catholicism, where it could be only Catholics and That's right. only Catholics approved by the Pope, right? Now you just, you know, you could get these folks all together. You get British folks, Dutch folks, you know, the Calvinists in France. I mean, they could all start working together to build this incredible society of wealth gathering. And in the meanwhile, and this was something you mentioned yesterday, Mark, in terms of convincing people to do things that were bad for themselves. In the meanwhile, the society that was being created, the living environment for regular people was just disgusting. Right? And there's this great section, and I did post this paragraph on my Facebook page about how, you know, an indigenous person living in North, South, Central America in the 16th century, if you had taken them to London, they would have been horrified by the living conditions, because it was basically people wallowing in their shit, rampant disease everywhere, rampant poverty and starvation. People were just miserable. Like, here's this country that's becoming, you know, the biggest empire on earth slowly. People that say that they could divide the globe and take over the earth and have conquests over everything, and they can't even feed their people. Right. Meanwhile, somebody in North America who's, let's say, living by Lake Superior, living up here in Minnesota somewhere, you know, they're eating fish, they're eating wild rice, they're, you know, eating meat, they're having a great old time. Like, they're having this beautiful life in connection and in conjunction with the rest of the natural world. And meanwhile, Western Europe has this form of Christianity that has just created nothing but misery.
Think about how we narrate that. So, like, the way so this is where myths are so powerful. And, like, yep. I've brought these things up to people. Like you said, there's 75 pages of endnotes in that book, which people are, by the way, asking what the title, publisher, and author is again. So maybe sharing that real quick, just to get that out there.
So again, it's called The Dawning of the Apocalypse. And it's by Gerald Horn, Horn with an E at the end. But yeah, The Dawning of the Apocalypse. And the subtitle, which isn't important to find the book, but just shows you what he's weaving together here, is The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century.
And so the 16th century, you know, what the narrative we're told is Europe was moving from feudalism to capitalism as a good move towards more freedom universally.
And civilization.
We're universally told that capitalism is better than feudalism across the board, which is just not true. It's just too complicated to say that, which I could say more about that. That we are civilized, gaining democracy and freedom. Meanwhile, there are these savages running around half naked, murdering each other all around these places that we're about to colonize the hell out of. So we're doing them a favor.
Right.
And that other things like are beneficial, like we have more freedom. With the advent of capitalism, you have a real pathway for peasants to work their way up. Like all these sorts of stories, we're told them so universally that if you challenge it and suggest, even still, I was at a very progressive gathering and there were some black church leaders trying to convince this prominent progressive white spiritual leader. I'm not going to name anybody. People can message me privately afterwards. trying to say that there was an African empire out of, I think, Malta, right? That was just not like strong, and they had a huge economy, and there was these great strides, and it rivaled anything happening in the world at the time. And this white progressive leader said, that's not possible. They weren't at that level of development yet. So these ideas of development. With indigenous primitive people here, and then you get civilizational stuff, and then it kind of somehow white society now always ends up being the most progressive and developed. So that grinned over top to justify all kinds of horrid crap.
Yeah. And then, you know, the funniest move in that regard, which I just find, I mean, the level of racism is unbelievable, right? Whenever we do unearth some example of unbelievable engineering, civilization, building, civil engineering in the Western Hemisphere, what does it get chalked up to? Aliens.
Yeah.
Right? So we find these things, right? Like there's this amazing, you know, city in Nebraska, thousands of years old, you know, all of this cool stuff on the plains, high plains in Chile, everything. Does anybody say, oh, wow, you know, these indigenous civilizations were really advanced? No, they say, how could they have possibly have done that? They couldn't have done that. It must have been the aliens. It's like, oh my God. I mean, and people don't even see how racist that is, right? They just don't even get that. Right. And yet, if you look at what happened, for example, I was just hearing this this great example of this in South Carolina. You know, this plantation, which now is, you know, one of these great like wedding destinations. The only reason that it doesn't flood and the only reason that people were able to be fed there is because the Africans that were brought over brought with them rice, as well as a knowledge of civil engineering, so that they could create this dike system that is still working, right, 400 years later, so that this place doesn't go underwater. So we got a whole series of comments and people saying hi. And
Someone asked about where, Hannah asked where she can find the recording later. Just on these Facebook pages where you're at now, like when this is done, it'll be shown as an archive video. We also have, we'll have a link at the end to our YouTube page, where which is the most accessible list of all the archived episodes. And this is also an audio podcast that goes out. So I'll have a link there too.
Reverend Dr. Moss is with us and people are excited. And, so
Medina is having a family moment.
Yeah.
So these comments.
Kathleen is part of the rebellion.
Oh, here we go. Kathleen writes, so proud to be in Missouri, home of Senator Hawley, who wants to lead the reversal of the election. Yeah, I can tell you're really proud, Kathleen.
Yeah, really excited.
Gus writes, Hannah, oh yeah, we shared that. Ceres writes, that is so much trauma. No wonder there's much relational and cultural dysfunction and maladaption.
Right.
And a lot of money trauma that being projected within themselves and the world. This is a thing, like it was, you know, this is worth pointing out, this white supremacy thing really screws up white people. So you have this dynamic, like these groups around that were going around the world into Africa and the New World, they call themselves adventurers, like this adventurer society, which sounds delightful until you realize what they're doing. And they create these spaces for colonies, but then they need people for the colonies. So people get ripped out of their context because capitalism or the remnants of feudalism are screwed up for them. So then they go to a new place trying to get a new world, and they create the life that they want that oppresses other people, but is still coming from a deep wounded place from themselves.
You have to think about, right? I mean, what does it do to you? What kind of human being does it turn you into to kill 1.5 million people over the course of your, you know, if you think about 20 years, right? So that's my, you know, over the course of your midlife. Like, what does that do to you to be a part of that? Or the other way around is, what do you have to have done to you to begin with to be able to do that? Right. And so, you know, then again, Mark, as you said, you know, when little kids go to school in America and hear, oh, you know, the founding fathers, and this was all wonderful, and, you know, bringing all this great stuff to the world. And it is no wonder, right, that there is a reaction from the current white supremacist party, i.e. the GOP, saying, don't teach this stuff, right? Don't teach the 1619 curriculum. You know, don't read books like this. Don't do critical race theory, because if you are to do that in any kind of accurate way, you know, that just has to explode these myths. Mm-hmm.
CQ writes, life is one ever-evolving disassociative disorder. We talk about disassociative stuff as a lot, and it kind of is for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's hard not to. Like, why not disassociate? Because this reality is crap for a lot of people. The deprogramming is going way, it's way more work than I thought. That's true. Gus writes, I was going to recommend this. Thanks for bringing it up. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is... The Indigenous People's History of the United States is another book that's making a lot of the same points that you're talking about, Dan. Reading it right now, it's incredible. I'd also recommend Open Veins of Latin America by Eduardo Galeano. Just astonishing, like these histories, which now more people are hearing about, but it's still not dominant. It's still not mainstream to know all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Not in any way that it, where you're left feeling a sense of responsibility to change it anyway.
Well, and you look at the, you know, we talk a lot about the systems that are in place for this, right? So you look at the politics of textbooks, which, you know, is not something that one would generally think about, like how does a textbook end up in a school? You know, how does your history textbook end up in the 10th grade American history class, right? It's unbelievably political, and what it is largely driven by are these huge school districts, mostly in states like Texas. So for example, the state school district in Texas oversees, I think in total, the largest set of school districts in the country. California may be a little bigger, but I think that Texas is, if not the biggest, one of the biggest. And they retain this kind of iron fist on the textbook publishing companies. And basically, they will not buy a textbook that they have not approved. And so they will not buy history textbooks that tell accurately the history of America. And if it doesn't say, you know, MAGA on the cover, they're not going to buy it, which means that these companies are not going to publish them because, you know, they have a very limited market. And it's very highly controlled. And so that's how you get these myths being propagated, right? And this is why when the New York Times creates this curriculum, which is now free and on the internet for everybody, it becomes incredibly threatening.
And it's bizarre because it's not even, it doesn't even go far enough.
Right, it's not even that radical.
You know, I've had a lot of friends complain about how neoliberal it is, and it kind of is. It doesn't go very far, but it does tell a lot of important truth that has radical implications, but it doesn't go there, and so, or not enough. And so for that to be like, mm-hmm. can you imagine if the New York Times had everyone read the books that we were just talking about? Like, right. people would lose their minds. Ceres writes, people still can't believe that the Aztec people could build a city and temple that can be on a lake, which is now Mexico City.
Yeah.
Ancient right. aliens.
The aliens had to like lower it from their spaceship.
I find that, Susan writes, I find that curriculum propaganda to be despicable. Again, another book, Howard Zinn for the Win. A People's History of the United States of America is also one of these classic texts that opened up a lot of people's eyes and kind of really broke open the field for a lot of people. Ellen Wright writes, Texas A&M is also the biggest school for teachers.
Yeah, for training teachers. Yeah. Yep.
And number yep. two is Illinois State in Normal, Illinois, how teachers normalize society. Comment from Vershal. Being from the South, I definitely understand people struggling with history and context. The Lost Cause was rote history by the time I was in high school. And even so, if you show people primary documents that say things like our cause is linked inextricably with that of chattel slavery, they're still inclined to yell fake news. It's much easier to live with than comfortable myths. Yeah, I grew up thinking right. like that somehow the Civil War wasn't about slavery because that's the conservative. They have to retell the story to make it seem like conservatism was the winner. Medina writes, need to pop off for a meeting. Okay. Have a good day, Medina.
See ya.
You know, maybe it'd be good to pivot a little bit to talk more about how this moment we're in is connected with this past. It's kind of obvious at some levels. But.
Right. Well, yeah. So you have these historic roots, or as I've talked about here, you know, karmic roots that have set up this white dominant, particular type of Christian dominant society mm-hmm. that has convinced itself that it's the best possible society ever, the best way of doing everything ever, despite all evidence to the contrary. Right. And as a couple of folks said earlier, you know, the pull towards dissociation, the pull towards just checking out into this mythological world, to fend anything off with, fake news, deep state, you know, whatever, or worse, you know, anti-Semitic stuff, racist stuff, you know, Black Lives Matter is about eating white babies, you know, whatever the insanity is that fends this off from you. It's much easier to do that. And, you know, the paradox, as far as I'm concerned, from a Christian point of view, is that Christianity is supposed to be about confession and repentance, right? So it's supposed to be about actually looking at these things and saying, yeah, you know, this happened. This was wrong. This was bad. If I'm a white person, I benefit from this. If I, you know, grew up in America, I believe all of these myths. I believe, right, that rat-infested, disease-ridden London was better than a native city on the shores of Lake Superior. I believe that. Again, all evidence to the contrary. And so I want to let that in to allow for a personal transformation of peace and justice. Right? That's what it's supposed to be about.
It is not like
it's not.
I'm taking two world spirituality classes right now, one to finish my program at St. Kate's, another to start my doctor of ministry at United. And so it's interesting talking about this posture that Christians have of needing to defend their faith versus being humble and curious and sharing happily with what you have to share, but also listening with the possibility that you might learn something. Like that posture I never learned. So like this evangelical tendency to defend this as the one truth really is a lot. It's very similar to how Americans tend to defend our ideals, needing to be defended rather than shared with open hands. And so the same kind of defensive posture, this need for domination. We just see this in this response, and so it makes sense that evangelicalism and patriotism would become strange bedfellows. But in this context, it's not that, like, conservatives, I don't think, want to defend slavery. They've just so believed the lies that they tell, that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about state rights. Slavery was in there, but it was on its way out anyway. Like, that's the way they think. That the issue isn't defending the evils of the world, but that this myth, these lies, are so potent, but that if you actually allow anything to challenge them, you are suddenly struck with the choice. You can either kind of double down this cognitive dissonance and defend it, or you have to be open to the fact that you fucked up royally and that everything you've inherited is tainted with death. And so this is the moment we're in. Like, our civilization is being called to repentance, and the Trumpian thing is the most vocal and odious expression we have of defending our legacy as a good thing, because the alternative is all kinds of reparations, repentance, and a willingness to allow our dominance to fall. So it's
last night in Georgia, right? Trump got up and essentially, and I don't listen to him, so I just kind of read some of the characterizations and of these comments. But, you know, if somebody walked into an emergency room talking like this, you know, you'd put a 72-hour hold on them and pump them full of Haldol. I mean, he goes on a rant, this psychotic, delusional rant. And it's basically all about keeping himself and a certain form of whiteness in America in power. I mean, that's all it's about at this point, right? And so, but he's the president of the United States, so he doesn't get locked up and he doesn't get shot full of Haldol, which is what needs to happen. And so what we see in terms of this moment, right, relative to this history, is that when you have this history and this mythology, you then also have this incredible systemic drive to maintain it. Mm-hmm. And we are seeing that, and we're seeing a greater and greater sort of flailing of this, you know, in part because, and this is a good side of this, in part because there are more and more people who are becoming vocal, who are waking up, who are listening to the truth, and that is a threat. And all that whiteness has left at this point, I mean, if you look at Donald Trump as the emblem of what, you know, what does whiteness have left? It doesn't, it has psychosis. I mean, that's what it has left. That's pretty sad. I mean, and it's scary because it comes with a lot of power and a lot of people with guns. Yeah. But it also, there's also a patheticness to it. That it really is this kind of flailing of something that needs to die. It just needs to die and be transformed.
And this is something, like, every empire tries to rule with mythologies that are reinforced by a bunch of symbols, mm-hmm. so that we're conditioned. And when those start dissipating, or in places where they don't have hold, they have to use usually economic control first, and then physical violence, like, is really not the first choice usually for dominance, because it's the most naked and obvious, right? And we'll get pushback. So, but we see that. So, like, we bomb other places where they don't buy American, they're not into Americanism at all. Other places are allies that are kind of sympathetic. And here we try to, like, let everyone docile. But the more it becomes laid bare, the more nakedly aggressive our society has to become. And that's what we're seeing too. Like, more and more people are realizing this is kind of messed up. And so that's why we're seeing this shift. Fascism is, again, this the last gasp of capitalism trying to defend itself. When it becomes most naked and obvious in its, mm-hmm. its ambitions. But, and this, again, speaking about yesterday, this is why it's all the stranger. In order to maintain these illusions, people have to become demented.
Demented, right.
For the worldview to still make sense. Yeah. And to everyone else, they are extremely out of touch with reality, but within their worldview, it's like the whole world has gone crazy. And again, this is the perfect setup by evangelicalism. So here's a comment from Amy gets at this. But if you confess that you fucked up, it could mean your entire belief system is wrong, which is could mean you're hellbound. And here we see why hell is such a powerful tool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're, you know, and this is the spiritual image of the wilderness. You know, you're cast into the wilderness, which is a very unsettling place to be. You know, Buddhists talk about groundlessness. You're tossed into this place where the ground that you had is gone. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's very, very uncomfortable. And, all right. So we gotta start working through these comments here, Mark.
Kathleen writes, I'm troubled by the Exodus story. Oh, this is a whole other thing. Yeah. Where God supposedly wants God's people to conquer people who are just trying to live their lives. The conquest narrative should trouble us. And there's all sorts of ways we can dig into that. But like, we have to, at the very least, acknowledge that that story is part of the justification that was used and is still used for our own conquest. The righteous chosen people destroying the not righteous, unchosen people. Susan writes, my son attended ISU Labs School, U High. There was some exploration of history beyond textbooks, but not enough in my opinion. My son was one of only a handful of BIPOC, biracial students at U High, which is by application only. He felt to be in a neglected minority while there.
Yeah, I think we mentioned this before. Reverend Gregory Bentley has been on the show. His daughter just started a world history class this year. You know, so here's a black young woman comes into a world history class, which begins with the European Enlightenment. Like, that's the starting point for her world history class.
Wonderful.
It's like, oh my God.
Rochelle writes, weirder is people who do defend slavery. That's true. Talking about slaves who loved their masters, who talked about how well slaves were treated, except by a few bad apples. Having lived in a former slave country, in a place where I had to pass the slave market every day, you hear it. But you can also see the legacy of slavery even now. Yeah, or the Christianizing benefits. Like, it worked out for them in the end because they got the gospel. I've heard that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to diminish the fact that there are people who actually actively defend slavery in some form. I just think a lot of people who don't defend it are telling themselves a bunch of lies to justify all kinds of things. Gus writes, it's wild that we can have a word like Dickensian in the English language and people can think that England might have been anyone's sort of utopia. Jim writes, brilliant book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, Charles C. Mann, 2005, another book suggestion.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We need to have like a transmission library page.
That sounds like a lot of work, but
Gus is up for it.
Yeah. Gus, write those things down and the list. You're now official librarian. Stephen writes, that seems to be to me, before reparations, we need some kind of therapeutic practice for the Christian Trump diehards who have become so lost. It is hard to know how to take progressive action until they are able to reckon with their deviation into delusion. I know many who seem too far gone.
Yeah, that was really the topic for yesterday. Yeah, that's a big issue.
Vershal writes, I think a lot of the flailing against it is exactly because people realize that there is a real point to this discussion and they're afraid that they are on the wrong side of it. I think that's true.
Yeah.
No one wants to feel like crap. That's the general truth. CK writes, isn't that the point really, Dan? Trump is the ultimate poster boy for this way of thinking and is so widespread and okay, you can become president. It's funny. And meanwhile, a lot of these folks are saying they're being suppressed by the media and no one's allowing them to speak, even though we hear them constantly. Stephen writes, seems the issue with that cognitive dissonance is that for so many, their experience of self has been enmeshed with groupthink. Their church, their faux news echo chambers, etc. And developing a separate sense of self in order to heal may be beyond the scope of their capacity given their programming.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, the power of these cognitive worlds is very strong.
Just to get this in before moving on with comments, Con writes, I don't know Gus, but I second the motion for him to put together a library. All those in okay, it's been seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I don't hear anybody. Motion carries. Catherine writes, hello, Catherine. There is so much heavy spiritual work involved in it's true, accepting all of this for white people. And then we have to relearn how to experience joy, humor, and connection in the face of oppression so that we don't continue destructive patterns in that despair.
Amen. Amen. You know, and that's what healthy spiritual community is for, and why healing is so much a part of all the gospel stories, because we need a lot of healing. All right. Well, Scott sends greetings.
And Sari's also votes in favor of Gus.
Okay, so 3-0. Gus is the librarian. And we got something done today. All right.
We'll pay you in love and exposure.
That's right. All right, well, we're going off into the Georgia election results tonight, and we'll be back tomorrow for Epiphany and
tomorrow's Epiphany.
Whatever happens in Washington. So, see y'all.
See you.